This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Turn around, every now and then you get a little lonely and you never turn around.
Come around.
That's not even the right lyric.
Yeah.
Whatever. I don't care. I'm just trying to serenade our audience, Nick. Because we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And it's time to welcome, once again, everyone to the finale of X Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I'm Greg Phillips, that interrupting voice on the other end of the line. Get used to that. It is Nick Duke. We are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are bringing you a long book hunt. That's right. Once a month, we turn into the Long Book Hunters, and in honor of X Month, we are delving into a more recent X-Men collection that is actually trying to do what some have considered to be impossible, Nick.
Yeah, which is explain the continuity of the X-Men. Now, some would tell you certain individuals, certain balding aged individuals from Huntsville, Alabama would tell you it's not that complicated. But we'll be the judges of that here tonight.
That's right, folks. We are here to bring you a long book hunt here from the Ho-Ho Loon Plaza and the L-Shaped Studio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We want to remind you, of course, that you are listening to the longest-running weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
And that this show is being brought to you by the best in the world, Place to Be Nation. And we are here to
best in the world at what exactly?
At being the place to be, of course.
Oh, okay.
In your pop culture world. Or anyone's pop culture world, really, not just yours. We are here to talk about X-Men Grand Design. These are two... How would you describe these? These are actually two issues that are sort of oversized, I guess you would say. Oversized prestige format.
Yeah, the old prestige format. So the physical copies of these, if I remember correctly, or not the physical copies, the original copies of these are bound a little differently. They're bound more like, if you remember, Greg, what DC in front of us to compare. But the entire presentation of this, pretty much from the jump, has been different than your standard comic.
Yes, and so we are reviewing the collected edition that combines the two individual issues, although actually we're reviewing the Marvel Unlimited version. But for the purposes of our gimmick of the show, we're reviewing the collected edition, which combines the two issues here, representing X-Men Grand Design, the first part of this anyway. And before we get into this, what is X-Men Grand Design? Well, it is the project of cartoonist Ed Piskor. I don't know if it's Piskor or Piskor. Nick, do you have any indication on this?
No.
We'll call him Ed Piskor because I find it easier to say. Plus, it's fun to say piss. Mm-hmm. But no, Ed Piskor, he is an alternative comics artist and cartoonist. He has worked on sort of a sequel of sorts to American Splendor, and kind of got this gig with the idea that this would be a book about the history of the X-Men. Now, one of the recurring jokes that we've had on the show as alluded to already, is that the X-Men's continuity is so labyrinthine and so convoluted that no one can possibly explain it in a way that makes sense. Why is this? Well, there's a couple of reasons for this. Number one, Marvel Comics has had one continuity since, 1961, Nick, when it started.
In a manner of speaking, yes, but the problem is there have been numerous alterations to that one continuity over the years, and rather than ever full-on hitting the reset button, they have been picking and choosing aspects of their continuity since 1961, and so at times it becomes a bit hard to remember what has happened or in what context it has happened, because
I can tell you, retcons.
Yes, after reading this book, some of the events that I'm aware of have already been, I don't know if modern Marvel continuity sees them through a different lens or not, but they're a little different than what I've encountered over on the Marvel Age podcast thus far.
Yes, so there's a couple of things at play here. I read an article for a little bit of background on this project, and by read I mean skimmed. But there were some interesting thoughts from some creators about this project and what a task it is, because it's going to attempt to condense the X-Men's, God, what are we on now? 40-year history? 50-year history?
I believe they debuted in 1963, if I remember correctly. So 56 years?
Of history into one story, essentially. And try to account, by the way, for retcons. So things that played out a certain way in the beginning we are applying retroactive knowledge that may have come up in the 80s, the 90s, or even the 2000s to events that take place in the 60s. Now, this article from Polygon has some interesting quotes from people talking about the challenges of Marvel's situation. So one of the writers, Al Ewing, who has written Iron Man, Loki, and Avengers books, says, quote, as soon as you make it feel like a reader needs to have previous comics to get the one in their hands, you've lost them. And then Karen Gillan says, when a story is told across 60-odd years, made by hundreds of hands, the task of making continuity work becomes impossible. I don't just mean they can't be bothered. I mean literally impossible. He says, to read Marvel Comics, you have to simultaneously accept that the Fantastic Four watched the moon landings and that they've only been superheroes for a little more than a decade. In its traditional sense, continuity is broken. So already, how can Ed Piskor do this? Well, he is attempting to tell the stories sort of out of time, but in a visual style representative of the era that he's writing about. So in other words, he goes back to the beginning and he writes about the original X-Men, the original core group of five X-Men, and Professor X, and he draws them in the style of the early 60s, not just the comic book style of the early 60s. He does draw it like Jack Kirby. He does draw it sort of in that newspaper print style approach, but also in the fashion styles. People are dressed like it's the 60s. When it gets to later in the decade, they're dressed like it's about to become the 70s. So, he's trying to reflect the style and times of the earliest X-Men comics while applying continuity that was only revealed decades later. So, I'm trying to think of some examples here, Nick, but stuff like Bolivar Trask's son being an evil agent of this organization called the Right. He's applying that from the get-go, before the character of Larry Trask was ever introduced in the comics, he's seen here early on being inundated into his father's group. Cameron Hodge, another example of that, another character like that. The indication of the Phoenix Force
are seen in the
60s before the Phoenix didn't become a thing until the late 70s. So we're already in the 60s seeing signs here in this book of how the Phoenix thing was sort of an evolving story over the course of, 10, 15 years of real-time X-Men stuff.
Now, important question. I know Larry Trask is involved, but how is Larry Bowden involved?
Well, Larry Bowden at that time was a young man. That's why he was known as Larry at that time. And at that point, I believe he was just making his way through the Gotham City Police Force. as a young private. And I don't really call them privates. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I said that. But as a young officer, you know, beat officer. And I think, you know, he's certainly over the years will mature and change his name to Lawrence Bowden and become the man that we all know and love.
Yes. Now, how would he feel about the Phoenix Force if it were to enter a certain area?
Well, he would clearly indicate that that's not in his district. Therefore, it's not his concern.
Understood.
Yes. So Ed Piskor is doing this all through the lens of the framing device that he uses here is the Watcher explaining the course of mutants on Earth to a being called the Recorder. And I'm going to be completely honest with you, Nick. The Recorder is one of – I've never read Silver Age Marvel. Never. Except for a few Spider-Man stories here and there. The Recorder is one of many characters in this book that I've never heard of before.
Nor have I, actually. The Recorder is a new one, but I guess it kind of makes sense. In this society of Watchers, you have to record these events. You don't just watch for all eternity. I don't know. I'll go with it.
He appears to have two cassette decks as a chest.
Yes.
So that's certainly a unique situation. Our traveling fanboys. Now, it says here that here on Wikipedia that there is that the Recorders are a fictional robotic race appearing in American comic books published by Marvel Comics, and it doesn't tell me any more than that. Apparently, they've popped up in Uncanny X-Men number. No, I'm sorry. They first appear in Uncanny X-Men number 137, yes. So, anyway, that's kind of used to frame the evolution of the X-Men's lives and everything here. So, it's kind of hard to describe this. We're not going to go plot point by plot point. We're not going to describe, because there's no real plot to this. It's really just tracing the history of the X-Men from the earliest days of Charles Xavier as a child, mm-hmm. when he was born, in fact, through the rise of mutants with Namor the Submariner and his destruction of New York City, which is another aspect, I'll be honest, I've never heard of in Marvel. I'm sure it's a big part of Marvel history that I just never encountered as a kid.
I believe this is a reference to Golden Age Marvel, where, if you remember correctly, mm-hmm. Namor and the original Human Torch and a couple other characters that we see here pictured at one point in this X-Men Grand Design book they actually had a golden age of superheroes in Marvel that aren't nearly as well known as DC's golden age, but here's Piskor's nod to that. And a quick way to we could reference that if we wanted to, and is one of my favorite things about this book, actually, is mm-hmm. each issue includes essentially an appendix at the rear yep. that kind of tells you where each of these classic Marvel moments, X-Men moments, came from. Whether it be, you know, an X-Men book itself, an Avengers book, whatever, he essentially references every issue number and even in the case, I believe in some cases, pages in particular. So virtually every page of this book has a classic X-Men reference, not just a passing reference, a literal, like, cited reference to an X-Men comic, which is pretty cool.
Right. For instance, I'm looking at the back of the book here, and I believe this is the first issue, maybe it's the second, but he says, it says, Asteroid M first appeared in X-Men number 5. The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants took over Santo Marco in X-Men number 4. Mesmero debuted in X-Men number 49. And it gives you the year of these titles as well. So that's very, very helpful because I needed it. I mean, I'll be honest, stuff like the Super Adaptoid I'd never heard of, the character of Kukulkan, Locust, the Cobalt Man, I had never heard of Larry Trask. I had never heard of there's all kinds of X-Men characters that are in here that I've never encountered in my reading. I grew up a child of the late 80s, early 90s, so a lot of these.
The Submariner battled the Human Torch and flooded New York City in Human Torch Comics number 58 in 1941.
There you go.
The Golden Age heroes seen on page 3 are the Thin, the original Human Torch, Blonde Phantom, Blazing Skull, the original Angel, the Destroyer, the Witness, and the original Vision. Brian Xavier's involvement with atomic experiments was established in X-Men number 12. The unborn child Xavier did have nascent psi powers, as revealed in New X-Men number 121. So right there, he is referencing Marvel continuity that is roughly 60 years apart from 1941 to 1942 in the space of two books.
Which I don't know. We really haven't talked about our thoughts on this book much before this podcast, but I have to imagine, as a continuity nerd like me, that was probably pretty cool to you.
Oh, it was awesome. Like, the fact that he did the work, like he did the research, he took the time to cite his sources. This is awesome. I mean, like, as well done as the art is, this damn additional reading section at the end of each issue might be my favorite thing about it.
Mm-hmm. Same. It's a very Geoff Johnsian approach to wanting to make continuity fit in a way that, like, you have to modify it. There's no way to get around that. You have to modify continuity. You can't, you know, you have to go with whatever these retcons are that you're using. But to use these retcons and to fit them in and make them make sense in the grander context of X-Men continuity, not just X-Men continuity, but Marvel continuity, dating right back to, as you mentioned, you know, the Submariner and the Human Torch flooding New York City in 1941. You know, I mean, that's really cool. I'm a sucker for any time, and DC's usually where you think of this stuff happening, with tying in the Justice Society to the modern era and things like that. But Marvel can do it too, and I've never seen it as well done as it was in this case, like tying in all of these years of continuity. And for me personally, seeing how they would take later concepts, like the Phoenix was not a creation of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Right.
But to go back and put that idea, that concept that the Phoenix was headed to Earth as far back as the early 60s, and in terms of, you know, real life publishing, and that this, it almost creates this even bigger sense of inevitability that what's going to happen when the Phoenix finally arrives, because the Phoenix is really the thing that's moving in the background of this whole story, you know, driving characters like the Mutant Master,
right,
driving characters like the Stranger who shows up,
right,
which is not to be confused, Nick, with the Handsome Stranger, who of course was Marcus Alexander Bagwell.
Or the act of sitting on one's hand until it is numb and then performing certain acts.
Yes, or Buff Bagwell sitting on his mom's hand and getting her to perform certain acts. Allegedly.
Oh, man. Welp. Here we are.
Hey, I have just been involved today in a Facebook chat thread that involved a good friend of ours, Tim Capel, talking about Brian Dobbs' butthole being open at a truck stop. So
what? Why?
I don't know.
Explain the context to all our listeners.
I don't need to do that. I'm not going to reveal the dirty details of the talking WCW chat thread. It's exclusive, And you're not part of it, Nick.
Oh, I'm. Let me tell you something. My level of disappointment over not having another fucking group chat to be a part of is just soul crushing right now, Greg. Well, thank you.
Ours is a good one. Not like your Marvel Age chat.
Never mind. Never mind.
Anyway, yeah. So this is sort of an approach to this idea that is very novel, that is very interesting, and in my opinion, pretty well executed. All these characters that I mentioned that you would be introduced to later that are following the Phoenix, that are following this sort of overriding arc, and it actually made me think as I was reading the story today, the second part, that, like, gosh, the Phoenix story just works so much better when there's build to it.
Right. And you know what's interesting is, like you say, that the Phoenix story is kind of the thing lurking in the background of this story, but it doesn't even actually come to fruition. Like, you know, if you're counting X-Men Grand Design as one standalone story, and then Second Genesis, which is the sequel, as a standalone story, and then I think Extinction is the final as one story, we don't ever actually see the Phoenix arrive on Earth in this story. We're constantly being told it's coming, but all the action here involving the X-Men, no Phoenix to be found.
It seems as if she will show up in Second Genesis, but we don't know, which is the sequel, by the way.
I believe she does show up in Second Genesis just because I know the cover to one of them, which that's one thing we should go ahead and talk about. The covers to these are awesome. Like, mm-hmm. involving each one has got a different group of X-Men on the front with one X-Man at the very forefront, and it's split between two eras where, like, one half of the character's body will be a design from a very particular era, and the other half of the character's body will be a design from a different era. So, like, for example, even though this isn't the book we're talking about, one of the Second Genesis covers, Greg, is Jean Grey and her Jean Grey persona and Jean Grey and her Dark Phoenix persona split down the middle. Wolverine, for example, has one where he's half brown and tan and half blue and gold, which is the better costume, by the way. Cyclops has got one where he's half X-Man, half, or, you know, regular Scott Summers, so...
You know what's weird? On my Marvel Unlimited app, and this is what confused me, the cover for X-Men Grand Design number 2 is wrong on here in the gallery.
Yes.
It's showing one from Second Genesis.
Yes.
Because it's the Wolverine cover. Because I kept reading it, and I was like, why is Wolverine not showing up in this yet? And that's because they never get to that. They get as far as 1969 in the I guess a little bit beyond that, early 70s.
Yeah, the actual cover to number 2 has Iceman at the forefront. With a more simplistic early version of his iced over form, compared to the more conventional modern, you know, just normal guy covered nice version that we would see in later years.
So it's interesting to see how the covers play out and everything. Because I was waiting for Wolverine to show up and he does it, and then I realize it's because they only reach a certain
point in very early on.
Well, yeah, I know that, Nick. Very early on, he shows up with Captain America in the World War II era, when they're just kind of chronologically going from the early days of mutants. But he doesn't show up as Wolverine; it's just Logan.
Yep.
At that point,
that's true.
They get to a certain point. I think the last issue cited is 1969, even though there are concepts from much later on. So. There's a lot crammed. It's basically a decade. They're telling the 60s of the X-Men. And how he tells the 60s story is really impressive. The art is very of its time. It's designed to look like the 1960s X-Men comics. And as someone who hasn't read 1960s X-Men, Nick, how do you feel Piss Corps captures that time frame? And then we'll get to the more details of the art as well. But I wanted to get your perspective, having read the original X-Men comics. Do you think the visual style is pretty close, or is it distinctive in its own thing?
I mean, it's kind of both. Like, it's trying to do a 60s style thing without actually...
aping Jack Kirby.
Without aping Jack Kirby, right. So you've got the art style itself is you know, heavily influenced by pointillism. Like, it's intentionally trying to evoke that look and feel of what a printed Marvel comic looked like in 1968 or what have you. So I love the art style. The colors are great. The costumes are all era accurate as far as I can tell. We would certainly need an X-Men expert expert to tell us if the comics are actually period accurate or not, but all looks great to me based on my limited knowledge.
The exact quote from our good buddy is, what I'm saying is, after tomorrow, my schedule opens up like Brian Knobbs' butthole in a truck stop restroom.
Good Lord.
One wonders what happened to Jerry Sags, by the way. You don't hear a lot about Jerry Sags anymore.
Well, the only reason Brian Knobbs is still famous is because he suck.
Hulk Hogan.
Deke.
He suck?
The Hulk Hogan ass.
Which is a difficult proposition, by the way. I don't even know how one goes about doing such a thing. But
you got to really get in there, as far as I know. I mean,
do you need a straw to do that? I mean,
why don't we ask B. Brian Blair?
Well, fact the B. Brian Blair. Mm. We're not here to talk about Brian Blair, although he probably lived at some point during the 60s.
Did he? I don't know.
So let's talk about the art itself.
Yeah.
And for the most part, I thought it was very, very good. I really liked this very distinctive style. It did feel very 60s to me. It did feel very retro. It did feel appropriate to the stories and the characters that it's telling. I liked the young the way Cyclops was drawn different when he was young versus when you see him a little bit older in issue two. And the way that all these characters kind of grow during the course of the studies, I liked the way that he mimicked the ridiculous hair of some of the X-Men characters, whether it's Magneto, Quicksilver, of course, Legion, who shows up briefly with his spiked hair that seems to go to the ceiling like Marge Simpson.
Yeah, that's kind of awesome, really, actually, stuff. because the context in which that is happening has it taking place in like 1968 mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yep.
But the character looks like he stepped out of like 1988. It's like, yes, it is such an 80s design. And rather than try to redesign the character to make him fit in the 60s, Ed Piskor's is like, you know what? The character is who the character is, and just yep. leaves him there.
Yep. And he and the same way as with all these characters that are invented later on in the 80s or 90s or whatever, that are existing in the 60s. Even Mr. Sinister briefly shows up in Scott's mind, sort of manipulating him a little bit. And the professor sees him but doesn't really know who he is. And the implication is that we will come to know who he is later on, perhaps if they ever reach the 80s. So the art here is really good. There are a couple of things that bothered me a little bit. One of those things is if you're in a classroom shot, for instance, or a lot of the shots in the book where there are a lot of people on panel, a lot of the background people tend to not have faces. They're just kind mm-hmm. of blotches. And I don't know if that's intentional. I don't know if that's how it was in 60s Marvel comics a lot.
I think the idea back in the day anyway, and I could be completely wrong on this, is that in the original art pieces, I would be willing to wager there probably is a little bit more detail. But the printing was so bad back then that you lost yes. a lot of that. And I wonder if that isn't an intentional attempt to ape, again, the presentation of what a printed Marvel comic looked like back then.
You may be right. I may be crazy, but it just may be a lunatic you're looking for. Mm. By the way, Brian Leslie Blair was born January 12, 1959.
Good, so good Lord.
He was alive.
That was a Todd Weber-like age range there.
And he was around during the early days here. So the art is good. I really enjoy it, the way that he portrays all of these X-Men characters. They're all drawn distinctively. While the backgrounds aren't the best, but again, that may be intentional, I don't know, the characters themselves are wonderful. They're all distinct. One of the other things that was kind of a hallmark of my favorite era of X-Men, the early 90s, is that a lot of the dudes end up kind of looking the same, and a lot of the women kind of end up looking the same. And that's not the case, certainly, in this book.
No. Moira MacTaggert looks nothing like Jean Grey, who looks nothing like Magnus's wife that we see at one point.
Magna,
yes. Really, the characters, he does a really good job of making them look distinct, which, as you said, was an issue in the 60s, but not so much here. So it's very smart, him picking his spots to mimic the 60s and picking his spots to differentiate himself. I mean, really, again, artistically, as someone who isn't a big X-Men, you know, aficionado, I'm not looking for certain specific things. I thought this is as fine an artistic presentation as it could be, given what he's trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that when Magneto was wooing Magda in their youth, that he ever referred to her as liquid hot Magda?
Possibly.
Also, I admit to being confused when they escape from the concentration camp and they end up, you know, living together, because at first I thought she was his sister. And then
I did too, because didn't he have a sister like in the continuity at some point that was kind of a big thing? Or am I getting him confused with Hannibal Lecter?
Well, I don't know. I can't remember, Nick. It's been too long. All I know about Magnus is he ends up coming around in the end. He comes around, he joins the X-Men, then he turns on them again, he starts Avalon, he befriends Fabian Cortez, he brings an asteroid into the
existence. What's Avalon? I'm sorry,
Avalon was the replacement asteroid M, and was where he located when he formed his acolytes around the time of the Fatal Attraction story arc, when he was under the unknowing influence of Fabian Cortez.
And one thing, this probably played for you on a whole different level than it played for me, just because I don't have like most of these characters, I would wager, outside of the core X-Men, I had no idea who they were. I just kind of went with it because the story is intending to be just kind of a bullet points thing.
Well, you would think that it would play differently for me, but here's the difference. See, I knew a lot about this stuff just through like flashbacks in 80s and 90s comics, but I've never read the 60s X-Men. I've never read the 70s X-Men up until like maybe one arc from like the late 70s from Claremont and Byrne, maybe in a trade at some point. I strictly grew up with 80s and 90s X-Men. So a lot of this stuff was unknown to me that I had never seen played out. And there are aspects of continuity here that are influenced by modern X-Men comics, in specific details regarding Jean Grey and stuff like that, Xavier's mental blocks and all that stuff. So it's like a lot of this stuff was new to me. Because even though I consider myself an X-Men fan, I'm certainly no X-Men scholar like Tim or Todd, who are doing a great job going through the Claremont and Byrne stories over on Conversation Comics, which I would highly recommend folks to check out. It's really interesting to me to see all this stuff and how it's playing out in this book, because I want to keep going with this story because I want to see how it all goes without having to actually go back and read all these years and years and years of stories. So it's kind of an admirable thing to do. Now, Nick, here's something that would be very interesting and much more difficult to do even. What Ed Piskor just did for X-Men and what he's presumably going to continue to do, I think the idea is to do 6 issues of this.
Yes, he has already printed 5 have been released, and either the last issue of Extinction either just came out or is getting ready to come out.
So I would like to see this guy try to do that with the incredibly simple and easy to explain Legion of Superheroes.
You are tempting fate once again, sir.
I know I am.
We have already.
Saying, there are three or four different continuities at this point for them. 3 reboots and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Take it and just make it all fit together in a.
If
he can do it with the X-Men, he can do it with the Legion.
I've been told the Great Darkness Saga makes it. Great Darkness makes it as simple as you could possibly need.
I've heard that as well. I've also heard Superman and the Legion of Superheroes by Jeff Johns.
Right.
I've also
was that Legion of Three Worlds or whatever that was?
Oh, Legion of Three Worlds also by Jeff Johns.
Yep.
The Three Boot?
Yeah. X-Men Grand Design Extinction number two. Just came out this past week, so the final issue is out, and it will be collected. I believe the collected edition hits in August, so by August you will have all 3 volumes of his X-Men work, and I would imagine they'll probably do a big giant collection of all 3 of them bound together at some point, or at least a slipcase or something like that.
Ah, yes, number 2, which is about my cycloptic friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so all jokes aside, it would be interesting to see how he would tackle something in DC, which has rebooted its universe multiple times at this point, versus Marvel, which has tried to maintain a loose continuity. Although this is such a Herculean task, what he's doing here, and I gotta say, Nick, there are aspects about this that I would be tentative in recommending it to somebody that's never picked up a comic book, because the transitions
are non-existent.
Well, there aren't really transitions.
No.
There's no transitions at all.
No.
It's just stuff happening. It's this happens, then this. It's similar to sort of the begats in the Bible,
right?
Somewhat. Like so-and-so begat so-and-so. He begat so-and-so. He begat so-and-so. It's kind of like that. It's a series of chronological events happening, and you just have to remove the need for transitions between the thing. Because sometimes it's jarring. Sometimes you'll see Magneto do something, and then the next thing will be, then the X-Men fought some random magician.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really trying to tell.
And then Moira McTaggart worked on a reactor core.
Right. It's not really trying to tell a complete story so much as it is trying to provide you a Cliff's Notes, essentially, is what it is. A Cliff's
Think
Notes
of it,
to X-Men history. Summary version of the X-Men, essentially.
But it makes so much more sense than the wiki summaries do.
Right.
If you've ever tried to – I think one of the biggest obstacles to reading X-Men is when Wikipedia came along, and now that temptation to, well, if I want to read X-Men, I need to catch up on what happened in this story. And then you read it, and it makes no sense. They're invariably terribly written. The
combined psychic profile of both Charles Xavier and Magneto went on a rampage.
Yes. They will include links to other articles that are in turn even more complicated and labyrinthine to read. So it's the worst thing to do because it makes it feel like it's actually work to read these comics. So what he's doing is he's simplifying all that. So, and by he, I mean Ed Piskor. Pronouns, pal. But I gotta
God,
say,
I can't. You are now that Jim Ross is saying it. You're, you know, 4 years behind on the pronouns, pal joke.
Well, I suggest most of our audiences too, because none of our audience listens to Bruce Pritchard.
You don't know that.
None of the audience that we care about listens to Bruce Pritchard.
I bet Rebel Life Media is aware of Bruce Pritchard.
He's aware. I'm sure they're aware. But they also are loyal and strong listeners of our show, and we appreciate their feedback every week.
They are our number one fans, and it's
right now. I think they are. They have taken over as the top fan on our hard traveling.
Who was it before?
That guy from New Zealand.
That guy from New Zealand? What guy?
The New Zealand listeners that I was appealing to in our very earliest episodes.
I think you're making things up again.
Hello there. Welcome to the Head Traveling Fanboy. You know, those days. We lost them long ago.
Oh, yeah, they quit. They found your New Zealand accent offensive.
I have it on good authority that the fans and supporters of one Ho-Ho Loon are big fans of our show. Unfortunately, their numbers are not great, but they're there. But anyway, X-Men Grand Design. I really enjoyed it, Nick. I gotta say, even with the sort of jarring nature of some of it, I found it fascinating to the point where I felt like I had to consume it to get to the next one. You know, like I needed to get through it. And as soon as I finished this volume, I started reading on volume two as well, Second Genesis,
because
I'm interested to see how he does all this, and I want to know more. I want to learn more. It kind of did a lot to remind me of my love of the X-Men. They're my favorite, sort of at their best, you know, at least at the peak of my comic book fandom when I was a Marvel Comics fan. They were by far my favorite and the most interesting area of the Marvel Universe. I'm much more interested in their history than I am any other history in Marvel, and it's because of the characters. The characters are so unique. Everybody's different from one another. Everybody's got different motivations, different powers. You know, they're ugly. You know, a lot of them are. So it's like it's just different, man. It's just a fun universe to explore, and I love the fact that finally, probably 30 years after it needed to happen, somebody is coming along and trying to simplify this for somebody that might have never read an X-Men comic before, or someone like me that's a huge lapsed fan that hasn't read X-Men comics regularly in, God, 25 years.
Yeah,
you know?
That's one thing I'm interested in. Do we know, like, how recent he goes up through Extinction? Like, does that cover...
No, I'm assuming, my assumption, and I could be corrected on this by our listeners, my assumption is that each book covers a decade. So I think the first book is about the 60s, the second book is about the 70s, and the third book is about the 80s. That's my
suspicion. God, the 90s needs a damn recap more than any of them, I would argue.
I would agree. I would also suggest that it would take probably a novella to do it. So you'd have to bust out the DC omnibus format to simplify the 90s and 2000s. But, you know, but I think that's an interesting time. And at the very least, if they go through the 80s, it will leave you at a point where you can read all the collected stories thereafter.
Right.
So you can buy the Jim Lee, Chris Claremont omnibus. You can buy Fatal Attractions.
Or just hop on Marvel Unlimited for $9.99 a month, or I believe $75 a year, and check everything out that way.
Or $9.99 yen.
Mm. Which, by the way, equates to roughly, lately anyway, based on the exchange rate, like $9.49 American.
Mm.
Based on my PayPal account, anyway.
Wow. That's very interesting, Nick. It's very good information to have for when we take our trip to Japan in about 5 years.
I don't know. After that article I read the other day about how they're hostile towards American fans, I'm less anxious about it.
We'll be fine. We'll be fine. They'll look at our smiling fat faces and be like, you know what? These guys mean well.
They'll worship us as gods, as their new pale gods.
Yes. Look at it. Look at these guys. Look at these guys, huh? They respect our industry.
We'll bring the hard traveling fanboys live on location in Japan.
Oh, now that would be fun if the hard traveling fanboys is still happening at that point. We can have one from the live from the Tokyo Dome.
What are the odds? Let's not answer.
Not high. But that'll be great. And we can have super fans on. Maybe old Anderson and Gallows will be back over there by then.
God, don't
we
even
might be able to hang out with them.
You don't want to hang out with them.
I wouldn't mind hanging out with them. I don't want to hang out with you.
You don't want to hang out with them. That's what it is. Yes, that's exactly right.
But anyway, good now the if we do make our Japanese trip, we will have to reenact the movie The Wolverine to see how that all goes. But no, this was a really good book, man. I was a fan of it. What did you make of it?
I loved it. You know, it's interesting. We didn't really talk about the writing because the writing kind of isn't the point. It's just kind of narration for the most part. There's very little dialogue, so to speak. It's just, hey, here are events, and here's an artistic representation used within the simple framing sequence. So it's almost unfair to evaluate it. Yeah, go ahead.
When there is dialogue, though, to me, it's good. It's representative of the characters. Right. Nobody's out of character here.
Right, and it's all well done. It all fits within the story. So, big thumbs up from me.
Absolutely. And if anybody out there has read Grand Design and has some thoughts on it, please let us know. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page at Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. And if you have any drawings you would like to submit of the hard-traveling fanboys with great 60s X-Men hairstyles, you can email those to gregp@placetobenation.com or nickd@placetobenation.com. We've actually gotten a lot of great feedback in recent weeks on the show, Nick, and while we had just a moment, I was going to see if I can read some of the reactions we got to our X-Men movie rankings a few weeks ago.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, you got some interesting rankings.
We did. Certainly unique. Certainly just as valid as our rankings.
No, they're not.
In their way.
No, they're not.
In their own way.
No, they're not. Stop That's lying.
True. And
in fact,
you know,
one of the people I'm thinking of even went back on his own damn list, like not even 3 days later. So don't say they're just as valid.
Well, Mr. Bowden, I just... That is in your district.
There. The audience of two strikes again.
I'm fine with it.
Me too.
Well, I'm scrolling down a bunch of GIFs right now to get to the lists here. Wait a minute. Wait. I've got Ben Morse.
Oh boy.
The
here we go.
The illustrious Ben Morse, friend of the show, host of the Marvel Age Masterclass. Now he has issued an addendum.
Yes, he has.
This. But
because this first
list
was garbage. Hot garbage.
And speaking of which, I'm going to go ahead and read this list. Yes. At number one, he had X2, X-Men United.
Okay.
At number two, he had First Class.
Garbage.
Already off to a bad start here. At number three, he had X-Men.
Garbage.
At number four, Days of Future Past.
Okay.
At number five, Deadpool.
Okay.
At number six, Logan.
Garbage.
At number seven, Deadpool 2. At number eight, The Wolverine.
Garbage.
At number nine, Apocalypse. At number 10, I'm sorry. Yeah, at number 10, The Last Stand. And in last place, X-Men Origins Wolverine. Now,
well, at least you got the bottom right.
Yes, and I believe he has since revised this, Nick. Mm-hmm. What was his revision? Do you remember?
I don't.
Oh, wait, he's revised it. I see it at the bottom here. After listening to the full episode and rethinking things a bit, here's his new countdown. At number 11, X-Men Origins Wolverine. At number 10, X-Men The Last Stand. At number 9, X-Men Apocalypse. At number 8, The Wolverine. Ridiculously low. At number 7, Deadpool. At number 6, Deadpool 2. And number 5, X-Men First Class, a much more reasonable ranking.
But still way too high. I above both Deadpool movies?
And the Wolverine.
And the Wolverine.
X-Men at number 4. Logan all the way up to number 3 from number 6, so I'll give him that.
Yeah, but all right, go ahead.
Number 2, X-Men Days of Future Past, which is also risen on his rankings. And at number 1, X2, X-Men United. So there you have it. Ben listened to our show. He listened to the voices of reason.
Yes, exactly.
And he came through a little bit, even though he is the official villain of the Hard Traveling Fanboys universe. We do love you, Ben. We do love the fact that you submitted a list. Thank you very much, sir. We also got a list from none other than
oh God,
Andy Helene, who gave us at number 1, First Class. At number 2, Days of Future Past. At number 3, Logan, followed by The Wolverine, X-Men, The Last Stand, X2, Dark Phoenix, Apocalypse, and coming in below the turd line, Origins.
That is a list so bad that to take shots at it is not even, like, there's no point. Like, it is a list that, whose shitty nature speaks for itself.
Russell Sellers has submitted a list to us as well. At number 11, I'm just going to count them down from here. X-Men Origins Wolverine, X-Men The Last Stand, Apocalypse, First Class, X-Men, The Wolverine, Deadpool 2, Deadpool, Days of Future Past, X2, and Logan. A very fine list indeed.
I would agree.
Now, our friend the manager, Todd Weber, submitted his own list. And as you know, Nick, he can be prone to controversy at times.
Mm.
But here's his list. And this is counting down from 1 to 11. Logan, X2, Days of Future Past, The Wolverine, rated R cut. Deadpool 2, Deadpool, First Class, X-Men, Apocalypse, Origins, and The Last Stand. Another fine list.
Mostly.
Oh, what's your gripe here?
First Class over X-Men, and after having recently rewatched it, I don't think it's all that close anymore between Last Stand and Origins.
I would tend to agree. Even though there are elements of Origins that I liked and defended.
Yes, but yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now,
the same can be said for Last Stand, by the way. There are elements of that that we liked and defended.
Noted hater of the Fox X-Men movies, Tim Capel, good friend of ours, submitted his list. He said he will make us regret it. At number 1, he has Logan, so no regrets thus far. Then he has what was meant to be approximately 100 spaces between 1 and 2, which is then Deadpool, Deadpool 2, X-Men, X2, The Wolverine, Days of Future Past, Apocalypse, First Class, Dark Phoenix, The Last Stand, and Origins. Ooh, he is not a fan of Days of Future Past.
He doesn't like most things.
No, that's not fair. He likes a lot of things.
Involving the X-Men, the Fox X-Men universe?
Well, that's true. Well, yeah, if you narrow it down to that. But I know for a fact that he likes some Bunkhouse Buck matches. He likes the work of the natural Dustin Rhodes.
God almighty. Bunkhouse. Let's just put a bunkhouse in front of everything.
You wish that everything could happen. If everything happened in a bunkhouse, we'd be in a happier world, Nick. I can tell you that right now.
Bunkhouse.
David Sunday's list is as follows. At number 1, Logan, followed by X2, Days of Future Past, Deadpool, The Wolverine, X-Men, Deadpool 2, First Class, Apocalypse, Origins. I watched it recently. And, I mean, let's face it, Nick, arguing in our group is sometimes like punching a brick wall.
No, there's no point in ever doing it. Like, nothing ever comes of it.
So
unless you enjoy the exercise, you're not actually going to change anyone's mind.
Right. not changing hearts and minds here.
No.
But no, yeah, Jason Sherman, his list is as follows from 12. Oh, yeah, Dark Phoenix. From 12 to 1. This is an interesting list, too. He's higher in Dark Phoenix than many are. So, number 12, X-Men Origins. Number 11, Last Stand. Apocalypse, The Wolverine, Dark Phoenix, X-Men.
Wait, stop.
Yeah.
Okay, what? I need the numbers here.
At number 10, Apocalypse.
Okay.
At number 9, The Wolverine. At
what?
Number 8, Dark Phoenix.
Oh, whatever. Fuck off.
At number 7, X-Men.
There's
no way. At number
6,
First Class. At number 5, Deadpool. At number 4, X2. At number 3, Deadpool 2. At number 2, Logan. And at number 1, Days of Future Past.
Having Dark Phoenix over the Wolverine is arguably the worst take of any of these takes.
But he does have Dark Days of Future Past at number 1.
Okay, so. I don't care.
Ed Harris, legendary actor Ed Harris.
Ed Harris.
And listener of the show. Thank you very much, Ed. And this is another very controversial list, Nick.
Oh boy.
I want to build to this one, so I'm going to read to it from the bottom up, from number 1 up. So at number 1, he has X-Men Days of Future Past.
Okay.
At number 2, he has X2.
Okay.
At number 3, he has Deadpool 2.
Okay.
At number 4, he has Deadpool.
Okay.
At number 5, he has X-Men.
The
first one.
All right.
Number 6, he has X-Men Apocalypse.
Oh, no.
At number 7, he has X-Men First Class.
Oh, no.
Are you sensing?
I sense where this is going. This is unbelievable. This is unfathomable to me.
At number 8, he has The Wolverine. And at number 9, Logan.
What? Again, a take so bad, there's no need in even discussing it.
He does defend it. He does defend his position.
There's no defending it.
He says, a controversial ranking, I will grant you, but it just wore me down a bit too much to be as effective as it was for everyone else.
It's supposed to wear you down. That is the point, bro.
Don't have a strong desire to see it again. It's in good company. I feel the same way about Raging Bull and Taxi Driver. So, just not his aesthetic, I suppose. Number 10, X-Men Origins, Wolverine. And number 11, X-Men The Last Stand. One of a couple that kind of varied on the Origins versus Last Stand positioning. But yeah, that Logan positioning just blew me away, man. I was shocked.
It's not worth discussing.
But that's it. That's all that we've gotten so far. We may have had some on Twitter, I'll be honest, but I've forgotten. Twitter's been a bit of an interesting place lately. I've gotten tons of notifications. I've gotten solicitations for products I've never heard of. Mm-hmm. It's been an interesting time on Twitter. But I would also
photos of old Georgia and Falcons football players. Fill out your timeline.
Exactly right.
It's your favorite time of the year.
And I've learned via Twitter's marketing campaigns that it's the perfect time for everyone out there to get some trim. So go out on the town and get some trim tonight, folks. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got all the rest of the goodies for you. Rundown, we got JR, we got a little bit of reading and watching, actually, and we'll see what else comes down the pipeline.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. all of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlacementNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wingbar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboy Studios, and we've got a beautiful show ahead of you, but before we get to that, we want to tell you a little bit about what's going on around here, what's going on in the Place to Be Nation. For starters, in the newest Marvel Age, the Sarcastic Four dive into 1971 with the first of three parts. Covering the year. Excited about that, Nick? Well, you've already done it, so probably not excited about it at this point, but it's certainly something that was done.
It was done, and it's going to be done again two more times, because as it said, it's a three-part thing.
1971, big year.
Big year. Kree-Skrull War was 1971.
The eighth episode of Laugh In Theater has Andy welcoming hard-traveling fanboy Greg Phillips to watch one of the funniest movies of all time, Austin Powers International Man of Mystery.
That's me. We had a lot of fun watching the film, so Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Number Wonderful. And yes, I had a fun time watching Austin Powers with Andy Atherton over there. The Hard Traveling Fanboys, that's us. We've done X-Men Month. We did our review of Dark Phoenix. Did we love it as much as the critics? We did. We've done a lot for X-Men Month. So just we reviewed The Last Stand most recently.
Yeah.
In a dreadful episode. DC4U, the newest weekly comic show on the Pop feed, reaches its third episode with Russell and Todd talking Maven Raven about one of the hidden gems of the DC Universe app, Legends of the Superheroes, Part 1, The Challenge. Batman 66 fans don't want to miss this one. Nick and I have watched this. We have.
It's wonderful.
It is wonderful. It is.
Go ahead, Greg.
It is Mr. Wonderful. Jennifer Smith is back with a new episode of Freak Out Drive-In, as she welcomes returning guest Scott Criscolo to watch that hit 2016 clown horror movie. No, not It. Terrifier.
Well, actually, It came out in 2017.
On a new episode of NBA Team, Adam Murray and Andrew Reich are here to reflect on what's been quite the last week in NBA land. Nick, I think you know what the biggest story was.
The Hawks unloading Kit Bazemore's contract in exchange for backup point guard Evan Turner?
No, close though. It was the Utah Jazz acquiring Mike Conley in a blockbuster deal that will undoubtedly make them the new favorites in the Western Conference.
The Atlanta Hawks having what many consider to be the best draft of any team?
Nobody cares about the Atlanta Hawks, Nick.
Your Atlanta Hawks, Greg, I'll remind you.
Thought your favorite team was the Phoenix Suns. The Celtics. That's right, the Heat. No, I'm sorry, it's the Lakers. It's whoever Shaq's playing for at a given moment.
Well, he's not playing anymore.
Oh, I thought you moved on to Chris Paul, though, didn't you? So
no,
why are you not a Rockets fan?
No.
Anyway.
So much bitterness from you.
Hey, I've stood by my terrible franchise for 20 years.
Yeah, and in some cases stood by all seven of them in the NFL.
On a brand new PTBN Pop special, Andy Atherton, Scott Criscolo, J. Arsenio D'Amato, and Todd Weber get together to discuss PTBN's greatest song of the 80s, Tournament. Which brings me to the next point, Nick, that on June 23rd, which has already happened, the reboot of the greatest song of the 80s, Tournament, kicked off. There are going to be 6 polls a day posted for round one. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament and liking the page, that is. Be sure to weigh in. Now, Nick, you will be stunned to know there are 0 KT Osland songs on this list.
I'm not going to be stunned by anything. You know, whenever we do these music discussions here at Place to Be Nation, there is an undoubted Northeast bias that comes into play. You mean to tell me that acts such as George Strait or Alabama have no place on a greatest song of the 80s tournament? Well, a greatest song of the 80s tournament, by the way, that's what, like 900 songs deep? No. No, absolutely not. I will not accept
and
it.
There's an aversion to both country and Western, and don't even get me started on their thoughts on hillbilly music.
Right. And yet, we'll get as many yacht rock classics as we can in there. So, hell with all this, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, absolutely. Totally agreed here. No Diamond Rio. No Shenandoah.
I don't think Diamond Rio was around in the 80s yet.
Sure they were. Sure,
I mean, they were probably doing things, but I don't think they had any like songs that would be worthy of inclusion.
You know, this is the kind of content that people come to this show for. I'm going to look it up when their first hit was. So the one that I first remember is Meet in the Middle, and that was 1991. All right, that's fine. 1991. I was off by a couple years. But no Shenandoah, certainly. You know, talking about getting to the church on the Cumberland Road.
That was probably also in the 90s.
Oh, no, that was 89. I know that. Get me to the church on the Cumberland Road. Surely it has a wiki. They actually pulled up directions to Cumberland Road. Anyway, what the hell? 1989, yep. I knew that. Oh, what about Restless Heart? Remember them?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, they were a good band. Anyway, no country, not much country on it. There's a little bit of country. The Judds. I mean, come on.
The Judds?
Mama?
Mama, he's crazy.
He's crazy.
Oh, inspiration has stricken again.
The tournament has kicked off. It's going to be a race to the top between a lot of these songs. There's some really tough matchups because they were all put through a randomizer, so you want to make your voice heard. Nick, what's going on in the wrestling world?
Over at the PTBN Wrestling Feed, on the newest episode of The Main Event, Scott, Nate, and Steve recap New Japan's Dominion, look ahead to the G1 Climax, and then discuss AEW's TV deal with Turner. That's right, Ted Turner. On the Place to Be podcast, Justin Scott and Steve Bennett are back inside the home office for a dive inside the 9/30/89 Madison Square Garden house show. After a six-month hiatus, Steve Bennett and Peter Winson reunite to discuss their 10 favorite single-season sports teams on the wrestling feed of all time on the Adams Division podcast. In the ninth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben welcomes action wrestling champion AC Mack to the podcast. And on PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 is off and running with pieces on the Best Picture nominees for the 66th Academy Awards, the 1994 World Cup, and the miniseries The Stand. Also, excellent Network Adventure Team is back with a look at ECW One Night Stand 2006. And be sure to check out our social media pages and message boards at www.bigelow34.proboards.com. For information on joining our GWWE, PPV, and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Well, folks, with that out of the way, there's only one thing left to do now. Well, actually, there's a couple things left to do, but this is how we usually transition into our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comic books. It's a segment we like to call The Rundown.
Oh, Charles, welcome to The Rundown.
Mm-hmm. Well, big news in the world of Marvel film, Nicholas.
Yes.
In a race, a last-ditch effort, perhaps,
yes,
to catch up to James Cameron's Avatar as the number one movie-making film of all time.
Number one movie-making film?
Money-making movie film. Picture cinematic experience of all time. Avengers Endgame is getting re-released this very weekend with, allegedly, extended footage, deleted scene, a little tribute, and a few surprises. So it says here that there will be a deleted scene, a tribute, and a few surprises. Yes, so anyway... it doesn't sound like there's going to be a lot of necessarily extended footage here, but
no, roughly 7 minutes, and part of that is part of that 7 minutes is a message from either Anthony or Joe Russo, I forget which one, and that also that little tribute they talked about. So in terms of actually like story related content, maybe 3-4 minutes, best case scenario. And yet, mm-hmm. I don't care. I love the movie so much.
It's enough to get me back in the theater, probably. Right.
I've seen
it 3 times already.
I've got my tickets for Friday at noon, so I'm looking forward to it.
How many viewings will this be for you?
I want to say 5. I know I've seen it one more than you, or maybe 2 more. Let's see. I saw it opening night. I saw it with you guys that weekend. I went back 2 more times. Yeah, so I've seen it 4 times.
And I've seen it 3 times.
This will be my 5th.
Once with the guys, once on my own, and once with my parents. So,
if there were anybody you knew who had mentioned wanting to see the film, good excuse, Greg.
I don't know anybody like that.
Okay.
So far as the audience knows. What's the next thing here? So the next thing would have to be that Spider-Man.
Nope.
Which is coming out with a film called Far From Home. Maybe crossing over with that motorcycle that just drove by my apartment.
The Spidey cycle was a noted part of various aspects, various eras of Marvel continuity.
Kevin Feige, Marvel Studios president, of course, has said that Spider-Man and Venom are, quote, likely to cross over in film at some point. While at a press event for Spider-Man Far From Home, the Marvel producer answered a question about the possibility. He says, I think it's probably up to Sony. Sony has both those characters and has Venom in their world. I don't know what their plans are for another Venom or if they're doing that, but it seems likely at some point. Now, I have to say, Nick, from reading that quote, it makes it sound like what he's saying seems likely is another Venom movie, not necessarily a Venom and Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, I would assume that's also what he was saying. But headlines...
headlines lie.
Headlines are intended to draw clicks, Greg, and we clicked on
it. We fell for it. We've been hoodwinked, ladies and gentlemen. We have been hoodwinked. We've been bamboozled. Cornette got us again.
Or maybe now that I'm reading it myself, maybe he. I don't know what he's saying. Honestly, I can see how you could read it either way.
Yeah.
I do think that Venom being as well received as it was by audiences and making as much money as it did probably helps that case. Because originally he said, you know, they wanted no part of it, and now if there's money to be made, you kind of. I mean, and Sony, again, the MCU has the rights to Spider-Man pretty much at Sony's discretion. That deal could end at any given point unless they renegotiate with Sony. So I would think if Sony wants it, he would probably be more willing to play ball in an effort to get Spider-Man locked in for future Avengers films.
Mm-hmm. And there's really no great reason not to do it. You know, just have Tom Holland pop up, you know?
Yeah. The only thing about it is if you're going to do a full-on, like, Spider-Man versus Venom film, I still think it's kind of weird to have a version of Eddie Brock Venom running around that, like, that Spider-Man, that Peter Parker never played a part in the origin story, you know? Mm. That there's no, like, association between the symbiote or symbiote and Peter.
Symbiote.
Yeah, it's a little weird still to me, but I'm sure they'd find a way to work. Kevin Feige is involved, I have all the faith in the world.
Well, I hope you have that same amount of faith in C.B. Cebulski and the crew at Marvel Comics. Because,
oh man,
weeks now, they've been hyping an event.
It was for one week.
It was
literally a week.
We haven't been talking about it on the show. We haven't mentioned it on the show because we just, I think, just didn't do a rundown that week or something.
No, but they started it. They started the hype machine. You know, the announcement came out last week, and it came out after we had originally tried to record our show. So if you remember correctly, we had that item on the rundown to talk about the teases that were there, and we decided, we don't know what this is going to be. Let's just wait. We'll cover it whatever it is next time.
Then we ended up not doing a rundown at all.
No, we did a rundown. We just didn't want to add anything to that rundown the fact. We were so just over it at this point that we wanted to move on. So we knew about this last week whenever the version of the show that you heard released, but we decided to hold it for this week. So basically what happened was, and I'm not looking at the Newsarama story, but basically what happened was Marvel started releasing these series of Spider-Man-related teaser images featuring a spider spinning a web that had a number in the center, and they had a 4, and then a 3, and then a 2.
And the 4 one in particular got people talking that it could be a comic book adaptation of the unmade Sam Raimi Spider-Man 4.
Or a Fantastic Four crossover, or some sort of something. Then you had 3, then you had 2, and then all along the way, you had all this speculation, all this fan hype that was going on. C.B. Sobolski was, you know, the editor-in-chief, was building it up as something no one would see coming.
Yeah, it was going to be a major announcement.
Right. He's openly mocking all the fan theories on online and stuff, just having a great time with it. So we're all thinking, man, this is going to be a really big deal. And then
they made the announcement this week that the big reveal is a new Spider-Man 5-issue miniseries.
A miniseries.
Drawn by Sarah Pacelli.
Which is cool. Good for her.
Colored by Dave Stewart. And written by J.J. Abrams and his son, 20-year-old Henry Abrams.
Okay. You and I discussed this offline. And yes. Our thing is kind of, let's say Marvel just kind of randomly dropped this. Mm-hmm. Out of nowhere, like just stuck mm-hmm. it in their solicits, didn't hype it up. They were just like, hey, here's this cool thing that's happening.
Or they just waited for it to, even if they did a press release yeah. saying, hey, J.J. Abrams and his son are writing a Spider-Man miniseries.
Right, you just announce it out of the blue. Cool. Like, drop the announcement, fine.
I'd have no issue with it.
Nobody would care. Well, there's an aspect of it I think people would still care about. But nobody would feel as, like, upset or disappointed about it because you had our expectations for something that was actually going to be legitimately important, because a 5-issue miniseries being written by somebody who's probably not going to write any more comics in his career and who is not going to be working with the guy with Nick Spencer, who is currently crafting the ongoing Spider-Man adventures, it's probably not going to be that important from a storytelling standpoint. And he's never written comics before.
It's not going
before.
To influence the greater continuity.
Right.
So you're banking on it just having to stand alone as this great work of art alongside a miniseries like, you know, like think of like The Dark Knight or something like that, Spider-Man. But it's not going to be that either, so probably. We don't know. It might be the greatest Spider-Man story ever written. But the bottom line is you can't hype something to that degree and then deliver that kind of an announcement. It's like, Nick, now this is an out-there scenario, but it's like if you're running a wrestling company and you promote a special guest referee for like 3 weeks.
You're getting ahead of yourself.
And you tease every possible top star in the business to be the special referee, and then you get there and you reveal a low-card act that people are not that interested in. That's not fair, low-card act, but an act that is not that...
A high card act that people don't view as a high card act. How about that?
Yes, and you reveal that as your big reveal. It's like that, Nick. So that's pretty much what Marvel did here. They delivered, as JR would say, a fart in church as their big announcement. And that's no knock, by the way, on J.J. Abrams and Henry Abrams. I watched the video of them talking about this. Henry seems like he's super excited about this. He's a lifelong Spider-Man fan. I have no problem with him getting a shot to write this comic. Neither do I have a problem with CM Punk writing a comic or whoever. Raven back in the day wrote a Spider-Man comic. You see this all the time from DC and Marvel. People write random miniseries,
okay,
and they don't matter. But you can't hype it up to this degree.
The aspect, the Henry Abrams aspect of it, the instances that you just noted, CM Punk or Raven or whoever else, those people have done something to earn notoriety in their lives. What has Henry Abrams done?
He's been J.J. Abrams' son.
I think that's the point that people are kind of making.
Sure. Yeah, but I mean, the fact that I'm a world-renowned plumber doesn't mean that I necessarily should write a Spider-Man comic. But, again, they do so many of these miniseries every year that don't matter, that fly under the radar. Kevin Smith is still writing Batman miniseries this, and he has a large... I know he has a large...
That's not going to happen.
What?
He allegedly is writing Batman miniseries that we'll likely never see the light of the day. I think his most recent published comics work was a Hit Girl miniseries for Miller World.
But, you know, I mean, JJ's got his name attached to this with his son, so it's not just his son doing it. So I really don't have a problem with it. I understand the arguments.
I honestly don't either. I get why people are upset, but like,
but I don't think they should hold it against this kid. JJ was given an opportunity, and JJ said, "I'll do it if my kid can do it with me."
Right.
And if I'm the kid, I'm not turning down. If I was 20 years old again, I would be writing Spider-Man in a damn heartbeat.
Right.
Now, whether it's good or not is not – we'll determine when the book comes out and people read it.
But again, the issue here is really ultimately the hype.
We're here to talk about the publishing here, and which is the same – the publishing company, which is the same thing we talked about, by the way, largely. We had differing opinions on the story itself, but with DC, with Batman 50 last year. So this is not to that level of promotional.
No.
But I think that this is is this in any way surprising, Nick, that they delivered such an underwhelming announcement after hyping it up for so long?
A little bit, because typically when Marvel goes out of their way to hype stuff, even if it winds up being underwhelming in the end, it seems like it's going to be important at first, if you understand my meaning. Like, they will hype it up like this big in-continuity story that's going to change everything, and it isn't until the end of the story that everything's undone and we're back to the status quo. This, as soon as it was announced and I read the press release, I was like, oh, well, this doesn't matter at all, and just dismissed it, you know?
That's it. Yeah, like, and it's not even saying things that aren't in continuity don't matter.
No, but you understand what I'm saying. It's not going to shape how Spider-Man stories are told for any period of time, you know?
No, and it's, again, I have no issue with the comic existing. I just think that these comic companies are just, every time something like this happens and you do this lame duck announcement, I just think of how happy I am to not be invested in corporate comics right now, like modern weekly, monthly comics. It's weird to say because I know for a fact that there are great comic books from DC and Marvel right now. Mm-hmm. I'm just not interested in reading them right now.
Yeah.
Which is sad because we do a comic book podcast, but I can't help it.
It is what it is.
Now, on to the next story, which is staying on the printed page and moving over to the distinguished competition. We've dedicated the entire episode to Marvel, but we got to get some DC news. And that is the news that DC is canning the critically acclaimed Vertigo line of comics. We talked about this last week, didn't we, Nick?
Maybe a couple weeks ago. I don't remember when we talked about it. The rumor was out there, and now they've officially made the move.
Yes.
Vertigo,
DC Zoom,
and DC Ink are all gone. Yeah.
And
which in the case of Zoom and Ink, like, it feels like those were just, I mean, I know it's been like a year and a half, but it feels like those were just launched like yesterday.
They were. However, after thinking about this story, Nick, I think this makes all the sense in the world, and I can't believe it wasn't done years ago, because here's what they're doing instead. They're launching three labels, which will be DC Kids, focused on readers ages 8 to 12. I'm pretty sure that this is DC, which will be readers 13 and older. Those are your main superhero titles. And DC Black Label for content appropriate for readers 17 and above. And they will be brandishing these with the age, the numbers of the ages that are going to be affected for these titles. Now, is it necessary to rename Vertigo into Black Label? Not really. They chose to do that for whatever reason. But
it's not just a renaming of Vertigo into Black Label. They're also kind of taking a new look at publishing. I know, for example, Safe Sex got moved over to Image, no longer to be published at Vertigo. I wonder what the marketplace is, if there even is such a thing, for a non-superhero or non-DC universe-focused adult property to be released by Black Label, if that makes sense. Or are they getting out of that game altogether?
I get the impression that they're not getting out of that game, because I think we're seeing stuff like Superman, what is it, Superman Year One?
Yeah, but that's focused on a DC Comics character. What I'm saying is something like Safe Sex, something like Preacher, something like Transmetropolitan, an example like that of what Vertigo used to publish that had nothing to do with the DC Universe.
And it seems like those might be predominantly put into the creator-owned imprints, like Gerard Way's Young Animal, Warren Ellis's The Wildstorm, mm-hmm. whatever they're calling Bendis's imprint.
Oh, God. Wonder Comics.
Wonder Comics. I think it says, the article here says those will continue, a Hollywood Reporter article. But I like this because I thought about this over time, and like I know that we all have attachment to the Vertigo name and what it represented, and it's true. It represented creativity and freedom in a way that no other label did at the time. But Image and Dynamite and Boom and all these other studios have kind of done that and taken it to a different level now of creator rights and everything. So if you're going to be a corporately owned comics, Karen Berger talked about this on Twitter, the corporate comics and creative ingenuity do not go together. So I think that if you are going to be publishing these comics, it makes sense to put the age numbers on there because we know what Vertigo means. We knew what Zoom and Ink meant, sort of, when they launched because we follow this stuff. But think about the 8-year-old kid that wants to go to a comic book shop and takes it, and his mom takes him there for the first time, and she's looking on the shelf. Does she really know what Vertigo means? Does she know that a Vertigo comic she shouldn't buy for her kids? Now, theoretically, this is where the comic book shop owner should come in and say, hey, you might not want to get this for him. This is a Vertigo title. That means it's for adults. Or, hey, maybe he'd be more interested in this, which is more appropriate for his age range. Unfortunately, you and I both know that a lot of comic book shop owners, not all, certainly, but a lot of comic book shop owners that I've encountered don't take the care and the time to do that kind of thing, to have that sort of relationship with their customers. They're just going to get, they're just going to see the dollar signs of that initial sale. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like the idea that they're putting the age range up there more prominently so that parents know what they're getting into and so that kids know what they're getting into.
Right,
so,
but you could have done that with Vertigo. Like,
oh, absolutely.
DC Black Label as a name doesn't signify anything like in and of itself.
No, but they're
it's the age number that you put on the thing.
But what I'm saying is that at the end of the day, it's just the title. It's just the name of the publishing company. And like you said, it seems like they're kind of getting out of that business of the Sandman and the Preachers of the world,
which sucks,
and focusing on the licensed characters, I suppose you would say, the existing characters. So, which I guess Sandman was an existing character, but still, you know what I'm saying.
Was he? I don't remember the specifics behind all that.
I've never read it, but apparently they tied Sandman into the Golden Age Sandman. So,
there you go.
But yeah, so one day we should probably read The Sandman for one of our Longbook Hunters episodes.
Yeah,
but
probably.
Anyway, that's a thing that's happening, and that's all there is to say about that. So, there you have the rundown. There it was. That means it's time, once again, for Reading and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What have you been reading and watching? Duh. Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is where we talk about what we've been reading, which is nothing outside of X-Men Grand Design, and what we've been watching, which I have been watching a couple of things, actually.
Mm.
I have viewed, in the last week, Episode 3 of the Doom Patrol on DC Universe app. I'm way behind, but David Sunday and I have resumed our watching of this series, and it continues to be batshit crazy. things that you would never think you would see on a television show, you will see on Doom Patrol. Very enjoyable, very entertaining. Acting is great. Big recommendation on it. There was one moment of atrocious CGI, but other than that, everything was good. Everything looked great. And again, I cannot fathom, or I cannot stress to you enough how weird and zany it makes Legends look. Cookie cutter by comparison in terms of the craziness of it. Now that's no knock on Legends. I still love Legends, but it's Doom Patrol is just very, very strange.
Good to hear. I plan on diving in at some point, although I don't know when that's actually going to be.
Probably the closest comparison I can think of would be Legion on FX, but this is zanier than Legion was. Zany, like Legion was weird, equally weird in its own way. But Doom Patrol is weird in a more zany and kind of...
Is it zany?
Fun-loving way. It's actually Kevin Owensy.
Mm.
And I also watched a couple episodes of Supergirl, including what I think might be my favorite Supergirl episode to date. of the series. And that is an episode called The House of L, with just the letter L, which is a flashback episode explaining exactly how many interactions Lex Luthor has had with Supergirl's world since the beginning of the series. How he's been sort of operating these machinations behind the scenes of everything that we've seen to this point. Operating in the background, building this new character of the Red Daughter. And we get to see the Red Daughter as well and learn more about her. I thought this was excellent. I thought John Cryer was great as Lex Luthor. I thought Melissa Benoist was fantastic, playing a totally different version of Kara, who nonetheless shares some of her qualities. It was a great episode. And then it was followed up with another really good episode that was about the search for Eve Tessmacher. Yeah, big, big fan of this direction for Supergirl. Excited to see how they wrap up this season.
Absolutely. I think I still have to watch the season finale. I've watched everything else. It's on another thing that's on my to-do list.
It's on Netflix now. No commercials makes a huge difference in watching Supergirl.
Good point. I should probably pull that up.
And with that being said, that's it for reading and watching. So I cannot help but to look at the hourglass leaning against the wall in the studio, and it's indicating to me that based on the lunar alignment, it's time. The Wrestling Minute. Well, we just came off the heels of another WWE pay-per-view event in the form of WWE Stomping Grounds, Nick. Mm. What were your thoughts on this WWE presentation?
Mostly, I guess, middling reviews. I was going to say mostly not good, but I think the last like hour of the show just left such a negative taste in my mouth that it overshadowed the good that came before, predominantly really good tag team match with New Day and KO and Sammy, and then also a good Ricochet and Samoa Joe match. But, man, that main event went over like a fart in church. And I feel bad for literally everyone.
It went over
involved.
Like a J.J. Abrams and his son announcement on Riding Spider-Man.
Yes. I mean, it does no one any favors. It does Seth Rollins no favors because he has to be in a bad, heatless match. With an angle that no one cares about, and the fans feel borderline misled, I would argue. It does Baron Corbin no favors because it continues to get him what I would argue is the wrong kind of heat, and yes, I think such a thing does exist. It does Lacey Evans no favors because she continues to be, I would argue, a bit overexposed for the, you know, for where she is in her career at this juncture. Mm-hmm. And it does Becky Lynch no favors because one of the appeals of Becky Lynch to this point has been her independence as a character and her lack of reliance on others to do her work for her. And yes, I understand she was coming to Seth Rollins' aid, but I don't really need her to have an on-screen alliance with Seth Rollins to make me care.
Yes, I am very trepidatious anytime they involve a real-life relationship on screen. Mm-hmm. I think the chances of things going wrong are high. However, apparently Becky and Seth are all in on this story at the moment and are putting in their thoughts on it. And I think the idea of it is to have a reversal of the traditional wrestling relationship where she kind of wears the pants in the relationship. I guess I'm okay with that. I've kind of made my peace with it because I'm very much against it. I don't think it's needed. I don't think it's good for either of them yet. I think if they had waited till after SummerSlam, I would be okay with it because they'd both be established as their in their roles as the top dogs in their divisions. But they're going to do it. I think that's fine. But there are better people to do it against than Baron Corbin and Lacey Evans. Andrade and Charlotte would be a
yes.
natural fit for this.
Now,
role.
Granted, maybe this is just like they're doing this to establish the Seth and Becky thing on screen and then moving on to a possible Charlotte-Andrade thing. And if that's the case, that would be good. But
I read an alternate theory online that I'm from just a fan theory that I'm,
oh,
that I'm
God.
Trepidatious about.
Oh God.
You know.
Oh yep. God.
Old Steph and Hunter.
Yep. Oh.
Just a fan theory. Probably won't happen. Hopefully won't happen. And the thought of it is like on the surface, I'm like, I actually started thinking about it at work, Nick. I was like, I could actually see that. That wouldn't be the worst thing. And then I thought about the match.
The promos.
I thought about Triple H working on Seth Rollins' knee for about 15 minutes, and I'm like...
Or Steph trying to emasculate Becky, and not emasculate's the wrong word, I understand that, but trying to intimidate and look down upon Becky in every promo for 6 weeks or whatever.
And wearing stilts in the ring.
Yeah, wearing borderline stilts.
But hopefully it's Charlotte and Andrade have to do that. But anyway, yeah, so that was...
Wants to wrestle, I mean, why not Brian and Brie? Brian's a heel right now.
Because it would involve Brie wrestling?
Yeah, you know, but I would almost be okay with that rather than Stephanie and Hunter getting themselves over for the 38,000th time.
At the very least, it would save us babyface Triple H.
Yes. That's a good point.
Anyway, yeah, so that's happened, and that's a thing, and AJ Styles is back now. From his injury. Hopefully he won't get injured again anytime soon. And he appears to be in a storyline with our boys Gallows and Anderson. And perhaps Ricochet, we don't know yet. I haven't watched SmackDown.
We don't know.
And Kofi Kingston's now feuding with Samoa Joe, which is, I'm sure, welcome for Samoa Joe to get into the main event picture. So there's some good stuff going on with the bad. And also, we continue to count down the days to our trip to AEW, Nick. Coming up right around the corner.
It'll be here before you know it.
And this weekend is Fyter Fest, which we can watch for free on the Bleacher Report app, which I've already downloaded. Weekend? Yep, I've already downloaded it on my Roku gimmick. So
BR Live. Yeah, I need to get on that. Mm-hmm.
So with all that being said, I guess that's all for the Wrestling Minute. We will be back with you more next week once we've watched Fyter Fest.
Absolutely. And... here to close out the show, as he is each and every week, ladies and gentlemen, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross.
Wait, Nick, before we get to this, well, let's tell the folks what we have coming on the show next week.
Coming on the show next week, we're going to be kicking off Spider Month with a countdown of our five favorite Spider-Man villains.
Excellent. Now, get back to your intro to Mr. Ross.
Yes, this week's song was actually teased by Greg at the very beginning of the episode. It's almost like Greg knew what was coming. So here we go, JR.
Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit lonely and you're never coming around. Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit tired of listening to the sound of the internet. Turn around. Every now and then I get a little bit nervous that the best of all my years have gone by. Turn around. Every now and then, I get a little bit terrified of some of the bumps that the young men are taking in this business. They're not selling. They're not taking their time. There's nothing wrong, folks, with working a headlock. You know, Danny Hodge used to work a hammerlock for an hour and 15 minutes just to get warmed up in a match. Anyway, then I see the fucking look in your eyes. Turn around, bright eyes. Every now and then, I fall apart. Turn around, rosy cheeks, Connie. Fucking every now and then I fall apart, and I need you now tonight. I fucking need you more than ever, and if you'll only hold me tight, we'll be holding on forever, and we'll only be making it right, because we'll never be wrong together. We can take it to the end of the line. Your love is like a shadow on me all the time. Shit, I don't know what to do, and I'm always in the dark. We're living in a powder keg and giving off sparks. I really need you tonight. Forever is going to start tonight. For fucking ever is going to start to once upon a time, I was falling in love with your high cheekbones. Now I'm fucking falling apart. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart. You know, fucking once upon a time, there was a light in my life, but now there is only love in the dark. And that darkness comes at the hands of a group of people, predominantly male, predominantly young, predominantly defiant. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the Bret Hart.
Our traveling fanboys.